All right, gentlemen. Do y'all have a Bible? Okay, and a pen. In just a moment, I'll send some handouts around, but before I do, we're just going to begin with a brief sort of an overview of what we're going to talk about for the morning. If you're following along, you know the title for the morning. You know the main guy for the morning, it's Job. We've all, or most of us, probably are somewhat familiar with the story of Job. And Morley refers to this as the principle of suffering with no apparent reason. What do we do with that? What do we do with those times? And this is the way he describes it. It's not the only time he uses this idea. But it's kind of unsettling, actually, and this is the idea. He says, we are either moving toward a period of suffering, and by suffering, we're not talking about I'm sick for a week. We're talking about an extended period. As a matter of fact, is there anybody right now who can say I really identify with a season of suffering? It was 5 years. It was 6 years. It was a decade of my life. Is there anybody brave enough to say right now, I'm going through that time? See, maybe it's possible because we're so disconnected sometimes that I can drive to work next to somebody who's in that season and never know it. I can sit next to somebody in church on Sunday morning and never be aware of the fact that they're going through this season of suffering. So coming back to his idea, he says that we're either moving toward that season, in other words, it awaits us. Well, that's really encouraging news, isn't it? Or we're in it, we're living through it already, so we don't have to get ready for it, it's our current reality. Or we're leaving the season. So my goal here this morning is that we develop a collection of ideas that will equip us for the time. Jesus spent a lot of time while he was on earth prepping his 12 guys for what would be their eventuality. But I think it's pretty clear to say that they didn't get it all. And so the words that you hear this morning, whatever it is that you take away from this, you're not necessarily going to understand the full implication of the words until the reality intersects them. The best that I can tell you, if you're not in that season or have never been through that season, is kind of store them away for the day when they show up, when that season shows up. So here it is. Here's the first phrase. We would like to be able to move through this season. Let me send a handout around. I wasn't going to, but you probably need something to write on. Does everybody have a pen? Anybody need a pen? There you go. Anybody else? What, did you have to wait until I got back there before you put your hand up?
Thank you, Glenn.
Okay. Does anybody else want to watch me make a third trip to the drawer? Good. All right. So when we enter this season, we have a choice to live, and this is the first couplet, to live in fear or to live in trust. The second couplet, to live in doubt or to live in assurance. Remember, we're not talking about I had the flu for a week. We're talking about the bottom has dropped out of my entire world and everything that I thought I believed is now being challenged. We'll get into that in a little bit. So, to live in fear or to live in trust, to live in doubt or to live in assurance, to live in hopelessness or to live in confidence. Think about how hard that is. Suppose that your current reality was challenging everything that you thought you understood about God and about fairness and about life and about yourself. How do you live in confidence and hope and trust at a time like that? And finally, to live either in despondency or to live in resolve. So I'll repeat them one more time now that you all have something to write with. To live in fear or to live in trust. To live in doubt or to live in assurance. And these are choices. To live in hopelessness or to live in confidence. To live in despondency. Or to live with and in resolve. And just so we set the stage for this, so that we really feel this, how many of you did any reading in the book of Job this week in preparation for this? How many of you have ever read through the book of Job? I see a lot of hands that aren't raised. You got to do this. You got to do this. Before I go on, let me clarify something else. Some of you may choose to throw stones at me at the end of this, but that's okay. Some people look at the book of Job and they say this is a real story about a real man. Other people look at the book of Job and they say that this is a carefully constructed, divinely inspired story about a developed character who the writer takes through every difficult circumstance as a way of exploring how man relates to difficult circumstances. Yes.
And that's not, you know, those are true. There's what one school of thought says another, but the school of thought that says he was a real man says that this is probably, because the Bible's not, you know, chronological order there, the oldest character in the Bible.
Right.
Before Abraham, when it talks about, if you read through Job, he describes some creatures. He's describing a dinosaur. That's what he's describing. He's looking at, he's seeing. So there's also, he is that ancient of a person.
All right. Let's take a look at some of Job's lament. So if you have a Bible, you want to turn over to chapter 7. And in case you're not familiar, if this is all reviewed to you, I'm sorry, I'll do it quickly. But Job is introduced as a righteous man. We're going to come back. Well, no, let's do that right now. Let's go to the first chapter in Job, and I want you to see and appreciate this. Chapter 1, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was... Is everybody with me here? That man was blameless. What does that mean? There are four unique descriptive words used here to introduce us to Job, and they're selected for a reason. So he's blameless. That means that in his community, amongst his people, amongst his family, nobody can point to him and say, yeah, he's the cause of my problem. He's the source of my difficulty. He's the guy who ripped me off. In other words, he has a solid reputation. The next word, and he's upright. What comes to mind when you see that word? How is it different than blameless? And he carries himself well. In other words, when Job walks down the street, he doesn't walk with his head down and his gaze off to the side, hoping that nobody sees him. He is a man who is comfortable in his own skin because he knows he's doing the right thing. But what's the tendency of people that are like that, that know that they're upright and doing the right thing? What's their tendency? They can lean toward pride. So look at the next thing. He is a man who fears God. In other words, he knows his place in the order of things. He doesn't set himself above God. He doesn't exert his own self-righteousness as the reason for who he is. And finally, he is a man who So this is his condition at present, but when a new circumstance that could cause him to slip or to stumble, when a new temptation comes into his life, what does it say? He turns away from evil. So all four of these components comprise the quality, the character of Job. How many of you figure that you measure up to Job? Okay, Scott feels that he does. All right, but he feels that modestly.
I'm sure you're going to interject this, and I did look ahead, but he had no law. He had no Bible, no scriptures. Just some communication with God.
So, this is the man that we're introduced to, and then into his life comes inexplicable disaster and tragedy. So unbeknownst to Job, and this is where Morley derives the phrase, suffering with no apparent reason. So unbeknownst to Job, this meeting takes place in heaven. It says Satan among the other heavenly beings and God are all meeting together, and God queries Satan, where have you been? What have you been doing? And he says he's been around the world and he's been checking on this. And God says, have you considered my servant Job? Have you taken note to him? And here's Satan's charge. Well, is it really a surprise that this guy serves you? Is it really, honestly, a surprise that he's righteous? Really? What does he get out of the bargain? Look at him. And if you read further in the introduction, he is, we'll say, one of, if not the wealthiest men in his community, in his time and place. In other words, well, it's no wonder he serves you, God. Look at the way you've blessed him. But I'll bet, if you stripped every blessing out of his life, he'd no longer serve you. And so this is the charge that Satan levels against God. The only reason, God, that anyone serves you, the only reason that people love you, God, the only reason that anyone would ever desire a relationship with you is because you bless them. They don't love you for who you are. They love you, God, for what you give them. Have you ever been a parent? You ever felt like Joe or like God? Yeah, probably. And so in two seasons, everything from Job is stripped away. Wealth, family, livestock, everything gone, except, perhaps unfortunately, his wife. For some reason, Satan spares Job.
Well,
just look away.
It, sure, that was part of the...
Yes, yeah, I'm sure it was part of the, yes. And then, when Job still retains his quality of integrity, and he doesn't despise God and doesn't curse God, and he deals with his circumstances uprightly, Satan comes back and says, oh, it's his health. If you just strip away his health, if you cause him personally to suffer physically, surely then he will curse you. And so God says, okay, let's put him to the test. So this is the condition in which we meet Job, where we're about to read. He has lost family, he has lost wealth, he has lost everything that helps him to understand what a man of integrity should expect from God. And he's in pain, he's in agony, and he's sitting there alone. Let's turn over to chapter 7. Has not man a hard service on earth? And are not his days like the days of a hired hand, like a slave who longs for the shadow, and like a hired hand who looks for his wages? So I am allotted months of emptiness and nights of misery are apportioned to me. For those of you who have gone through one of these seasons, what does night feel like?
Long.
It does, doesn't it? Maybe during the day there's something to take your mind off your difficulty. But there's nothing so alone as a long night by yourself. My flesh is clothed with, and look at these descriptions. Chapter 5, or verse 5, my flesh is clothed with worms and dirt, my skin hardens. And then it breaks out afresh. In other words, just about the time my skin starts to heal, new sores appear. And it starts all over again. Remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never see good. The eye of him who sees me will behold me no more. And so he's trying to make sense of this. Here is the God who I thought loved me. I thought he loved me, but it doesn't feel like he loves me. As the cloud fades and vanishes, so he who goes down to Sheol does not come up. He returns no more to his house, nor does his place know him any longer. And because of all this, he says, therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit, and I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. And then his friends come to comfort him. It was customary that a friend would sit with you for a period of mourning. There would be some silence. Just, that was actually respectful. For a week, perhaps longer than a week, you would just come and sit with that person, share in their grief, and then possibly some conversation would ensue. There is actually some wisdom to that. Have you ever been tempted to offer cheap advice to somebody who's going through a difficult time?
Oh, it'll get better.
Or, more probable here, have you ever been the recipient of cheap advice when you were going through a time of difficulty? Yeah. So finally, one of his friends speaks, how long will you say these things? And the words of your mouth be a great wind? And here is the crux of their understanding at this time. Verse 3, does God pervert justice? Or does the Almighty pervert the right? If your children had sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. What's he saying? Your kids clearly have done something wrong, and so this calamity that's come upon them is the result of their own evil. Well, it's difficult enough when other people say that about you or about your circumstance. Have you ever felt, though, that you were getting what you deserved? Have you ever questioned that? Did I bring this on myself? Was I not good enough? Was I not righteous enough? Did I do something wrong and this is my just punishment? So we're just going to hold all of these thoughts for a moment. Because here's the interesting thing. Our general human condition, it's on your note there, is that we have a hunger to survive and a desire to thrive. Not sure how I worded it there. But this is our condition. And what's the proof of that? Everything about us is fine-tuned and designed for that very reason. What is pain an indication of? Something's not right. Something needs to be addressed. Something about either my survival or my thriving is in jeopardy. Pain is an indication that something is wrong. Where does that come from? What do you feel like mentally when you're in danger? Your awareness is heightened. Your senses are perked up. Everything about you is fine-tuned to this. And emotionally, same thing. Here's the principle. We are fine-tuned and carefully designed for surviving and thriving. And if that's true, where does that come from? Is that all random chance? Just look out in the animal kingdom. How is it that an animal knows what to do almost from birth? You know, you could say, well, there is instruction in the animal world, and there really is, that young learn to hunt from their parents and all that. But how is it that right from its first breaths, an animal knows what to do to survive? Where does that come from? So if everything about this seems to be fine-tuned, carefully tuned for us to survive, where does that come from? And if that comes from God, then how is it that we can say that God is in opposition to us at a time of difficulty? Yet where do we typically level a charge when we're going through difficulty? God's abandoned me. God's forsaken me. There's something out of alignment here. The principle, if you fall asleep anytime during the rest of the morning, here's the main principle. It is almost self-evident that we are designed and intended to prosper and thrive in every area of life. That is the plan. And the plan has a planner, i.e. God. And if God has fine-tuned and designed this whole system for us to thrive, then God is not intentionally inflicting pain and suffering on us. So therefore, there is no such thing as purposeless suffering. Now that can be really hard to receive. But you and I tend to look at that as suffering affecting us. Let's take a look at the scriptural story. We go back to the beginning. We are placed in a garden, and we're going to go a little bit out of the order of the notes there. We're placed in the garden, and what is our purpose in the garden? Anybody? Pick fruit, run around naked? I don't know. Is it any deeper than that?
Take care of it.
That's it.
Enjoy.
That's it too. We are designed and created for a purpose. Okay? We are created for, it says in the beginning, we are placed in the garden. So in other words, in all of the earth, God creates this one unique little paradise. And he sets man in that paradise to tend and to care for it. And as Ron said, then to enjoy fellowship with God. So those are my two purposes as a human being. I am a steward, and I'm intended to enjoy God's love. It is impossible to understand anything that comes into my life apart from understanding my purpose. When I interpret anything that happens to me outside of my reason for living, I don't interpret it accurately. So just hold on to that. When I interpret pain that comes into my life because I haven't gotten what I want in the way that I wanted, I have to come back to a simple question. Am I interpreting this according to what my purpose is, or have I stepped outside my purpose for living? And if I am within my purpose for living, then what's the reason for the suffering? So let's take a look at where this idea comes from, because most of us, drilled right into us, is an assumption of justice and fairness. Would you agree with that? Most of us have an assumption about justice and fairness. If I do the right things, I should get the right results. So we're going to go back to Deuteronomy. Seventh chapter, I think we're going to go to. All right, so this is one of the final addresses of Moses to the people, remember? Book of Deuteronomy, a collection of these presentations given to the people. Now Moses and the elders of Israel commanded the people, saying, "Keep the whole commandment that I command you today. And on the day that you cross over the Jordan to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall set up large stones and plaster them with plaster. And you shall write on them all the words of this law when you cross over to enter the land that the Lord your God is giving you, a land flowing with milk and honey." Okay, so God says, as soon as you cross over into this land that I've promised you, this land that is going to, let's call it this, let's call it a marriage relationship. This land that is going to be ours. and we're going to share this land together. And what I would like you to do is set up a collection of stones, stack them up, and plaster them, and write on them the covenant that we're going to live by. And then whenever there is a doubt, whenever there is a question, we, that means God can say to the people, and the people can say to God, you promised. The people can point to that and say, you promised, God, that if we did this and this and this, that we would reasonably be able to expect these things from you. And God could point to that same thing and say, and you covenanted with me to do this and this and this, and this is how we are to live together. Almost like a marriage relationship. And so we get into some of these things. Turn over to 28. And if you faithfully obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all of his commandments that I command you today, the Lord your God will set you up high above the nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you. We don't have time to read all of the blessings. Take some time this week to read them. So, chapter 27. I want you to set up this reminder so that we can all look at it. These are the things that we're agreeing to. Chapter 28. Here are my promises to you. This is God talking. Here is what I promise to do for you. I'm going to care for you if you live for me. I'm going to protect you if you live for me. As you gradually take hold of this land that I'm giving you, I am going to scatter your enemies. But then there's the second half of the promise. But if you don't do these things, here is what you can expect. Now we turn back to the book of Job. This is the general understanding, the general mindset that we find that undergirds the book of Job. There are certain assumptions about if I live in a certain way, God is going to care for me. God's going to protect me. God's going to look out for me. What happens when it appears that someone has broken a promise? What do we feel? It's the best word you can use, isn't it? What else? Y'all gonna let Scott have the best and the last word, really? Huh?
Disappointment.
Disappointment.
Revenge.
Hmm.
That's how come with this one right there. That's real.
Okay, I heard anger out there. The desire for retaliation, is that an acceptable? What else? Boy, when you guys got in a negative role, you really get into it, don't you?
I think doubt.
Got room for two more. Got two more negatives in you? It's a good list, isn't it? Okay, here's the question. What happens when these are your experiences, and they're directed toward God? Have you been there?
Faith increases, trust diminishes.
What happens when, as Job says, and he's struggling with this, I sense, God, that you are the one who has directed this toward me. As a matter of fact, he even comes out and says in one of his laments, I feel your arrows It's your arrows that you have sent and that have hit their mark in me. You're responsible for this. And I have no idea what to make of all this.
Well, first of all, you start thinking that toward God, and then you're afraid that you're thinking that toward God. And how do we think that toward God and say that, you know? Yeah.
And then, and so let me ask the next question. If this is the way you feel toward and about God, and God is the only possible source of help that you have, what's the probability that you're going to turn to God for help or encouragement in your time of need? It's almost non-existent.
There's people we encounter that are real. You start talking to them, and you may have been there, or you talk to somebody, they just seem like real resentment, real anger. God, Christianity, they'll talk to me, and I used to be, and I was, and why are they so angry? Is there's a hurt in their life. There's a disillusionment, disappointment, you know? Although I was praying, believing God, and my brother died, or this happened, and they talk about, if you listen long enough and ask questions, there was this thing in their life, and they are greatly disappointed, greatly disillusioned. So they come to the point in their life, at that point, forget God. God is not there. He's not real. That's not true.
Which is a strange leap to make, because it's kind of like the quarterback has a bad play, so you give up on sports.
But don't you meet a lot of people like that, though?
Yeah, and that's what I mean. It's a strange leap with God. It's like one disappointment.
So let's, for a moment, let's bore right down into this text and let's read Satan's charge to God. Because what we get to see here is we get to see the inside of the story that Job never does get to understand. Remember that. We, as outsiders reading this story, we get to see the part in heaven that takes place. This is one of the reasons why a lot of people believe that this is a developed story. And here's God talking. Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth? A blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. And then Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? Have you not blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land? But if you were to stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, he will curse you to your face. Here's the first really deep question. We used to sing, I don't know that we sing it that much anymore, a song that has a refrain that goes, I am a friend of God. You familiar with that? Flip that around. Does God have a friend in you? When the chips are down, see, what is relationship? We talk about, honestly, we talk about a personal relationship with God, right? Isn't that what we invite people into? What does a relationship look like? Is it one way? What's the mark of a mature individual or mature individuals in a relationship? It's two-way. It's reciprocal. It is both giving and receiving. It is serving and expecting. The question that we have to ask ourselves, if we're sincere about this relationship, is, can God count on me? Do I not only point to God and say, he's my friend, he'll take care of me? But can God point to each of us and say, he is my friend, he is my advocate, and among the sons of men, he will stand up for me. How do people ever discover if God is trustworthy and faithful if there are no examples that people can look to? Remember what I said. We're here for a reason. We're here for a purpose. That's the story that is introduced in Genesis, and it falls straight through to Revelation. And that whenever we seek to understand our circumstances outside our purpose, we're bound to draw incorrect conclusions. Now, what if part of God's purpose for us going through some season of difficulty is not only what we learn, but what other people can learn about us and our reliance on God? In other words, is God just somebody we go to in the cheap and easy times? Now, here's the thing. At that time when that was written, people really did have a just reason to depend on God for their survival. In developed countries today, do most people look to God for their day-to-day survival? Of course not. See, we kind of understand how the world works. We understand how the weather works. We understand how crops grow. We understand the basics of genetics. We understand a lot of stuff. So the average person today in a developed country essentially says, I don't really need God for the day-to-day of my physical survival. And as a matter of fact, I'd even be so bold as to say that a lot of people would laugh at somebody who says that they really do need God for their day-to-day physical survival. You meet people every day who would say that. Is there more than that? Does our world today and the condition that our world is in give evidence of the fact that we have it all figured out? That there is nothing left for God to teach us? That there's nothing left that God has to offer us? And that in fact that we have arrived at the condition in life where we have everything in life mastered?
We think that, well, I think, and then you start saying, well, what's up with the weather? Why? You know, I mean, the scientists, why is this happening? And then we have a drought here and a famine here, and then we start, well, what is going on?
Yeah.
Someone started saying something, I'm sorry.
Let's make it even a little bit more personal. We'll compare Peter and Jesus, but there are comparisons throughout the scripture. Suppose that Jesus had interpreted his circumstances the way many of us do. Suppose that Jesus had interpreted his direction toward the cross as being God being in opposition to him instead of God for him. Because we tend to do that. But yet, what if the one thing that God most needs of you or needs of me in order for his plan and his purpose to go forward, what if we resist that? What if we reject that? What if we rebel against that? And I know this is kind of like heady stuff, and it's really hard to imagine that God could really use us at that level, but why not? Because if he doesn't use any of us, who's he going to use? Because another one of those big themes that you kind of like pick up at the beginning of the book and it kind of weaves its way through the whole book is that maybe God doesn't need to use us, but he chooses to use us consistently. He chooses to use people to reach other people. He chooses to use people to accomplish his plan. So his method... And remember the theme of this book? It's the ways God makes and molds and shapes men. That's the essence of these 10 chapters that we're looking at. Well, if one of the things that we can see as a general theme of Scripture is that God uses men to reach more men, God uses women to reach more women, you know, all that thing. What do we do with ourselves if we're unusable? What if we resist our purpose? What if we say, I'm not going to participate in that? And we have a choice. I mean, we can. A couple of questions that we're going to end with here. This is really short, and I'd like there to be some conversation and maybe some interaction at your tables. What can I learn about life in general that I can learn in no other way than through suffering? Nothing?
Faith.
What can I learn about life that I can learn in no other way than going through a season of suffering?
One thing is we really do need, God, you remind us that we really do need His help.
Humility.
Okay. Make your own list. I mean, this is because these are things that you're going to store away for that time in your own life. Anything else?
Perseverance.
Perseverance.
Which is the ability to suffer better.
Suffer longer?
Yeah.
And suffer perhaps without bitterness?
Yeah.
So you can suffer and not be cooperative in the suffering, right? Would you agree with that? Have you ever met bitter people? Have you been one of them? Do you look in the mirror to see the bitter person?
It's like that, what would Jesus do? Jesus would suffer. So he chose almost all the time. Suffer with his disciples. I'm sure he woke up every morning and said, when are they going to get it? Suffer with the Pharisees, Sadducees. All those religious people. He's the Son of God, and they're telling him what the rules are.
How has a season of pain or difficulty, remember season, not a day, how has a season of difficulty in some way transformed you so that you're better able to relate to humanity? See, it's really hard. Let's make it so simple. It's really hard to appreciate what it might be like to be starving to death somewhere if you haven't ever missed a meal. It's really hard to understand what it might be like to go through a year or two or three of cancer if you've never been profoundly sick in your life. Remember Job's friends? The ones who came with cheap advice? And I asked you, have you ever been the recipient of cheap advice, bad advice, lame advice? Just buck up. Well, God will go with you. It'll all be better. Where does that advice come from? Where does that encouragement come from?
People have never been there, done that.
Yeah, there you go. Have you ever noticed that after you have been through a season of difficulty, you struggle to find words to encourage people in a way that before it was easy to offer words? What can you learn about yourself in no other way? This is question number two. What can you learn about yourself in no other way than going through a season of suffering? You can, can't you? Learn your strengths and weaknesses. See, it's one thing to talk about persevering, right? We'd all like to think that we would persevere. We'd all like to think. Okay, how many of you have gone through a difficult season in a marriage? Didn't all of you in one form or another say some version of the for better or worse? Right, in one form or another?
You didn't say worse or better.
And here's the question. On the day that you said that, how many of you really understood what worse looked like and felt like?
Worse.
There's certain things that we learn about ourselves only through going through a season of suffering. And remember, if God has purpose and design behind our life, where we are, what we're doing, the seasons of our lives, if there is purpose and design behind that, then how is God going to equip us for what we're called to do apart from us going through training? And if that's the case, then is there such a thing as purposeless or senseless suffering? Okay, not final, but the next question, it's very closely related. It's not just what can I discover about me, but what can I gain that can equip me? And this is where you need to have a few close friends with some experience. For this reason, You can draw the wrong conclusion about your circumstances. And you can leave with the wrong ideas. Remember what John just said? Some people go through a season of suffering and what happens? They turn against God. They never trust God again. It's possible to go through the right training and develop the wrong attitude. So you need some other people around you, perhaps, that can help to fill out the weaknesses in your thinking. And here's one of the things that I think we truly learn only in seasons of difficulty. Am I really in a covenant relationship with God where I said to God, for better or worse, or am I in a transactional relationship, a contractual relationship, where I say, yeah, God, I'm committed to you, but only if.
There's a lot of people that way.
Wait, what? What I just described?
The latter, yeah. There's a lot of people that way. That's why Jesus was really upfront with, this is what it takes to follow me, but we're not hearing that a lot of times. You know?
I remember just to reading a few books and the people who really suffer, like either in prison or torture for a long time, they don't say, I'm stronger now. They say, yeah, I know. Like, faith in God is strong. God is strong, not me.
Mm-hmm.
It empties them. It isn't like I can handle anything. It's not like that. Mm. Interesting that it's through not everyone. If you read stories, that's the attitude. This is now that I'm a better person, I'm a stronger person, I can go through anything. It's like, I don't have anything but God.
I'm in this book, I'm in several books, I go back to this book. It's called The Seven Men, and it's modern day men. And it brings these kind of things out, what they went through in life, and their encounter with God and how that brought them through. And one is Jackie Robinson and Dietrich Bonhoeffer through Nazi Germany, this Lutheran pastor, and some others. And you begin to see these are what we would call great men. But they're lived like this, and what they had to go through and how they strengthened their character, their integrity, and their walk with God. And why they would consider them great men is they went through stuff and how they went through stuff and handled that. What they did. Eric Max something is the author, but it's good settlement.
So let me turn this around in a slightly different way to help you get a different perspective on it. Have you ever obeyed God out of fear because you were afraid of certain consequences? If you didn't. You didn't obey God out of love. Remember, that's the delineation that Jesus offers us. If you love me, you'll follow me. But in reality, that's not necessarily the way we do it. We kind of sometimes say, because I want these positive benefits in my life, God, I will follow you. Well, what if God strips all the positive benefits away? We no longer have to fear God because we no longer have to fear God in the sense that, well, if I do something wrong, God will take this away from me. Because now it's gone anyway. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because the thing that you were living toward God for, in the hope that, well, if I do this just the right way, God will be happy and God will bless my life. Haven't we all been there? Right? That's immature faith. That's child, not in a good way. That is childlike faith in a bad way. It's kind of like, if I can game God and fool him into thinking that I'm really good and I'm following it, but really deep down inside, all I want is his blessing. But if God strips all that away, well, then I do have the opportunity for the first time to find out if God loves me for who I am and if I love God for who God is. Somebody had their hand up. I think it was you.
I see it often. I see people befriend somebody because they are of a higher status. They have more wealth. They have more toys. They have more opportunity. And they kind of cling on to that person for those advantages and not for the relationship. Until the person realizes that they don't really have a friend, they have a handout, and then that relationship severs.
So, I mean, I can see the same thing in people, you know, in relationship with Jesus, that as long as things are good and I'm getting blessed, I'm connected, the relationship's good, but as soon as things start to fall apart and I don't get what I want, then I move on. So it's not the relationships, it's the results.
And you can very easily appreciate, when you bring all this together, you can fully appreciate Jesus' words, "Not everybody who calls me Lord, Lord is going to be with me forever." And it's not that it's God's intention to have an elitist, exclusive family. It's just that most people really aren't interested in relationship. Most people are very self-oriented. And it takes a long time to strip away the self-orientation from us. As I'm probably wrapped up, I think that's it. You know, this is the kind of thing that you only need a few points to take away from this, and it's mostly store it away, tuck it away, and it's there for when you need it.